Welcome to today's program titled Keeping Time Off on Your Side, Tips for Designing a Successful PTO Program. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call. Ms. Murphy, you may begin.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on where you are dialing in from. My name is Jillian Murphy, and with me today is my colleague, Christy Totten. We are both attorneys for Davis Wright Tremaine in our employment law group. I'm based in Seattle, although currently in my office in Spokane, where I live, and Christy's in our Portland office. And we are happy to be here to talk about PTO. This is actually a big day for me. It's my very first webinar. I've presented a lot in person, but this is new for me. So if it's new for you, hopefully this goes well. So we just thought it would be great to do a program on PTO. Christy and I both counsel clients frequently on this issue. I don't know about you, Christy, but I get questions about either leaves of absence or PTO programs definitely on a weekly basis, if not a daily basis. So we thought it'd be great to kind of talk a little bit about what we've seen our clients kind of go through and how they've been able to put together a program that works for them. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and go to the goals of today's program. Definitely feel free to post questions as we go, and if it's possible for us to just kind of weave that in, we'll answer those as we go. We may save some time at the end for additional questions. And if we see a question come through that looks like we'll be able to address that with a later slide, we may hold off on answering that for a while. So don't despair if we don't answer your question right away. And if we don't know the answer to your question, we might not answer it, but we'll certainly look it up and get back to you. So today we want to talk about PTO programs. We want to talk about helping you design a program or implement an existing program or tweak an existing program to meet your needs. And you know, there's a lot that goes into that. It's addressing absenteeism issues that may come up. We want to make sure we have a program in place for you that provides you with some flexibility, provides your employees with flexibility, and of course, as always, we want to comply with the various laws that affect time off programs. Some of you may be in cities or states that have paid sick leave ordinances. Washington is a state that's going to be enacting a statewide ordinance next year. FMLA, ADA, workers' comp law, all those things are going to be important to make sure that your PTO program complies with those things. And some other, you know, things we'll talk about sort of attracting employees. I think that these types of benefits, time off benefits, have become more and more important to employees. So we'll talk about kind of if that's a goal of yours, sort of how to think about that. So I'm going to go ahead and pass it on over to Christy to talk a little bit about our goals for today.
Hi, everyone. So a couple goals today, I guess four actually. One is to help you understand better ways to think about your organization's competing interests, because what your goals are for the PTO program are really going to drive what you decide to put into place. So are you in a company that really wants to encourage R&R, or are you in a company that really wants to incentivize people not to use very much of their time off? Is a goal that you need to compete in the industry because you're in an industry where PTO is very generous and that's what your potential workforce is expecting? Or are you in a place where you want to make sure you're legally compliant and you don't really want to provide anything else unless required to? So, you know, we talk a lot to our clients about, are you trying to maintain your culture, change your culture? What are you looking for here? And I think people do think about that part of it with plan design, but one thing that I think is often overlooked a bit is that there can be quite different goals within the organization amongst different employees or employee groups. I'm, you know, an evidence-based girl, so I looked up some surveys, and they were actually really interesting. So this survey was published by TriNet last summer in 2016, and what they found, which makes sense when you think about it, is that lower-paid workers are far more likely to save up their PTO for emergencies, so for a medical emergency, a family emergency. Higher-paid workers are much more likely to use their vacation, their PTO for vacation time or pleasure. And so I think it's really important to keep that in mind. Those who are administering the program may have a different motivation or reality about PTO, right? If I'm at the highest level of the company, I'm going to be in that higher-paid group that might be happy to use it as I can fit it into my workload, so I can go on a nice vacation. And I might forget that some of the people who are covered by my PTO policy have a very different motivation to bank their time, hoping that they'll be paid out at the end of the year, or hoping that they won't get stuck and lose their position if, you know, they have some sort of emergency come up in their life. The other thing that I found that was really interesting is that the difference between age groups. So this same survey found that older workers actually expect more time off than younger workers. You know, it was about half of all workers said that 2 to 3 weeks of PTO is ideal. That's about what half of all ages said. But when they asked, well, who thinks you need 4 or more weeks of PTO? It was about a quarter of the boomers said that, but only about 13% of millennials said that. Now, I suspect that's partly because the boomers have worked there long enough, they've accrued a lot of PTO and are used to having it, but I think it's a reminder to think about what is your workforce expecting, and the best way to find out what they're expecting is to ask your employees, right, and kind of take their temperature on what they're looking for in a PTO policy. So that's, you know, one thing we want to cover. Another is to really help you identify legal risks and pitfalls to make sure that rollout and implementation is smooth and that you're compliant with the law. Third is to make sure that you understand why your PTO policy is the way it is and why it works the way it does. If you don't understand it, then there's probably a pretty good chance your employees don't understand it either, right? And then at the end of this, we'll talk about some of the ways to get a good program in place, get the stakeholders involved, and be on your way to a successful program. So let's look at some different types of PTO policies. The older sort of standard, as many of you know, is the separate buckets, right? You got a bucket for bereavement, bucket for jury duty, bucket for sick leave, and so on. And what we've seen has been a real shift in the last decade to the global policy. I saw a statistic that about 28% of all PTO or 28% of time off policies were the global bucket in 2002, and it went up to 43% in 2015. So about half of companies are now using this global policy. And of course, it's not legally required to have a PTO policy at all, unless you're covered for some reason as, you know, a government contractor under Davis-Bacon or something like that. But these are choices that you make and that you're empowered to make to have them work in your workplace the best way that you want them to.
And Christy, I would just note that I'm actually seeing, I think that's exactly right. I saw a lot of folks moving from separate buckets of leave, traditionally like a sick and a vacation, to a combined benefit, but I'm actually starting to see a little bit of the reverse. I'm seeing folks now thinking that it works better to split these back out. I don't know if you're seeing that as well, but and I think some of it is, you know, here in Seattle, with the sick leave ordinance, you actually are, there's an incentive to keep those benefits separate. I don't know if any of you have noted this little kind of, I don't know if loophole is the right term, but if you provide a PTO plan and you're a larger employer, you're actually going to be on the hook to provide more benefits, more hours of paid time off than you would if you maintain a separate sick and vacation bucket. And it's interesting because you can use those two separate buckets. You can use the time in each bucket and look at those that time collectively to reach your benefit that you need to be providing under the ordinance. But there's, if you have them separate, you actually don't have to provide as much. And so I think there's some interesting reasons why employers may choose to go from one bucket back to two buckets. And of course, there's other buckets, like you might have a bucket of leave for your Seattle employees and then a separate PTO policy or separate buckets for your Oregon folks or your folks in different locations. You might have a different bucket for exempt employees versus a different type of program for non-exempt employees. And then you may have no bucket at all, or I've seen a lot of questions about these unlimited plans and how those might work, and we can talk a little bit more about that. If anybody, here's a call out to the folks in the audience. If anybody is interested in hearing sort of the benefits and pitfalls of an unlimited PTO policy, shoot us a comment and we can talk a little bit about that in more detail.
Yeah, I agree, Jillian. I've seen some companies shift back to breaking this out a little bit or breaking out their sick leave. And again, we'll talk about that a little bit more. I think one of the reasons for that is because, there's a lot of reasons that companies went to the global policy, right? Some of it is having a little bit more flexibility for employees who may not get sick often but want to take time off. So some of it's that kind of flexibility. But, one of the reasons was a simpler plan administration. And maybe that's not so simple when you have to weave in sick leave law, especially if you have to weave it in under multi-state locations. And so we are getting, look at this, we're getting multiple people on here about the unlimited. So yes, so there is a bucket that's not pictured on this slide, and that would be sort of an enormous bucket with no bottom. And that's the idea of take as much as you want. So this kind of started, I think, at least gained popularity in small, high-tech type firms. It really kind of works where you have a high-achieving workforce. What they found was that people take about the same amount of time off as they did before. Some workplaces didn't like it. I recall that the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times put one in place and they rescinded it like a week or two later because employee feedback was bad. We hear a lot about employees when they get in that situation of having an unlimited amount can feel like they don't know anymore what's expected, and they don't want to look like a slacker. So if you tell me I have 3 weeks of vacation and I'm encouraged to use it, then I feel empowered to take 3 weeks, and I know that that's not too much, and no one's going to think that I'm slacking off because that's what I get. But if you tell me I can take any amount of time, then you're thinking, well, what does that mean, right? Should I take, is it really okay for me to take off 5 weeks? What if that person's only taking off 3 weeks? I think one of the reasons that's attractive to employers, though, is that potentially it's a way to not have accrual on the books because it hasn't been accrued. So I think, you'd have to look at that closely to see how you structure it, but I think that's one motivation to have a policy like that.
Yeah, and there's, I think that's right. I think there are some risks. I here in Washington we have the Washington Family Care Act, which, so far in Washington State there is no requirement to provide paid time off except in some cities. But the Washington Family Care Act says, however, if you do provide paid time off, you have to allow employees to use it to care for family members. And I have had discussions with the labor and industries folks who enforce that, and I say, hey, how would you guys feel about, how would you look at that rule in connection with an unlimited PTO plan? Because if I have unlimited time off that's available for me to use for my own illness, does that mean I have unlimited time off to go care for my grandmother? And grandmother is one of the covered family members under that Washington Family Care Act. And that can't possibly mean that, Elle and I folks, that you're going to say, employer, you have to give this person a year off to go care for their grandmother. And interestingly, the investigators who they're pretty literal folks, and they said, well, it says what it says, and if you have provide them an unlimited benefit for their own sick leave, you're going to have to provide it for these other things. And so I really do encourage, I've helped clients who have been wanting to do sort of this unlimited PTO. It's really not unlimited. I think the way to structure this is to say, hey, we've got a plan in place where you can take the time you need for the most part. Generally, that's going to be around 4 to 5 weeks a year. We're not going to sort of track it. However, if you need 2 or more weeks off in one chunk, that's going to be administered differently. Or if you if this is an FMLA illness or something, or if this gets into sort of what we would consider an extended leave, we may look at that differently. But what we're talking about are these sort of a day here, sick day here, go to your kid's school thing on this day. That's the kind of stuff that we're saying, use your best judgment, get your work done. We're not going to really pay attention to that. But for these extended purposes, we do have sort of a different plan. I think that's one way to do it, and I think that's one way that the Washington Family Care Act folks would say, okay, so really, if you're not going to go get to take 3 months off to care for your grandmother, that's going to be looked at differently. So that's one thing to think about, I think, with this unlimited concept.
And I think that is an important point about the get your work done part. I would want to be really clear in the policy that part of this assumes that you're performing your job or having adequate cover, whatever's needed, because you don't want to, you want it to be clear what the job expectations are. Mm-hmm. So we kind of saw a wave of this happening. It was still, I think, very rare. It's not that many companies moved to it, but when they did, they sure got big headlines, and the initial reaction was, well, people aren't really using it any more than they were before, but it, I think, is a morale boost in that way. Let's see. Mm-hmm. So we're going to move on, I think, to the next slide, Jillian.
Yeah, and I'll just say I see a couple questions that having this extended illness bank or short-term disability plan, is that a way to sort of get around the unlimitedness of the unlimited plan? I think that it can be. And there's another question about, can you call it PTO but still have buckets for use? And we'll talk about that in a little bit. You still may need to know why people are using their PTO, and it can be helpful. So as far as this business about using an unlimited plan, I will just sort of close by saying it's tricky, and I think you definitely need to make sure you're protecting yourself, especially in Washington and other jurisdictions that may have may require you to allow you folks to use it for certain purposes. So moving on to the interplay of PTO policy and other laws, and I think this is why you're all listening in, because you realize that it's tricky. While there's no requirement in a lot of areas to provide paid leave, if you do, you better make sure that your policies comply with these other types of laws that are in place. So you've got the FMLA, which we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, that does require employers of a certain size to provide unpaid time off for certain purposes. So you're going to want to make sure your policy complies with that. Reasonable accommodation, so even if you don't, if you're too small, you think I'm we don't have to comply with any of this, well, you're still going to have to look at leave potentially as an accommodation under the ADA or state laws. And I will note that there's state versions of Family Medical Leave Acts as well. Oregon is infamous for having a particularly generous version of that. And then, of course, your paid sick leave laws, whether it's city or even county or state, those absolutely play into the administration of your PTO plan. And then, of course, wage and hour laws. Can we deduct from our exempt salaried person? Can we make them use PTO? How many hours increments can we make folks use PTO? When can we reduce their salary? These are the sorts of things that make planning a PTO program tricky. And so we're going to talk a little bit about those things. But I will say, just a shout out to our profession, I guess, Christy, is that anytime you're putting a PTO plan in place or thinking about changing it or, questions about it, I mean, it really does get tricky. And I will say you should reach out to your friendly neighborhood employment law attorney at some point in the process to just make sure that you're really keeping in mind all those legal risks that can arise with these plans. So let's see, I'm going to advance here to the next slide. We'll talk a little bit more about the FMLA. So as I mentioned, the FMLA is a benefit. It's an unpaid leave requirement. Employers of a certain size are, and I'm sure you all, this is not news to you, but you're required to provide unpaid leave for serious health conditions and other types of specific purposes. You know, that's, there's a 12-week cap on that. That's, it's a pretty generous employee-friendly law. The beauty of it is that it's capped, right? So you don't, it's not, you're not going to have to deal with someone's FMLA leave forever. They're going to have a certain amount of time that you're required to provide them, and then they're presumably going to exhaust that, and then you're going to have some more flexibility. Now, that is all well and good when people are taking chunks of time off, continuous leaves of absence, you know, 6 weeks for shoulder surgery and then another 6 weeks for something else. That's pretty easy to administer, and we're happy to do that, and it's easy to do. It's the intermittent leave that I think we all have come to enjoy trying to sort through. When folks have conditions that require them to be absent for short periods of time on an unpredictable basis, right? That's where things get tricky. So you've got someone who has a panic disorder where a panic attacks will come and go. They can't predict it, and they're at work, and they have a panic attack, and they have to leave in the middle of the day, and you have to provide them that time off. And it doesn't matter if it's hard on the business. It doesn't. There's no undue hardship limitation as there is under the ADA. You just have to do it. And it's, what's tricky about that is because folks are chipping away at their 12-week allotment, you know, few hours here and there at a time, you may be in a position where you're dealing with this on a year-long basis for employees year after year. The tricky part about the FMLA, obviously getting that time covered, making sure people are still productive, figuring out how to manage those absences, that's tricky. You can't discipline for absences that may be related to the FMLA. So that puts some obligation on the employer, perhaps, to find out, you know, if you've got somebody using PTO for a purpose that may be FMLA eligible, first of all, you can't discipline them for example, not calling in time. If you've got a PTO plan that requires a certain amount of notice or management approval and they're not getting that, and that they're getting dinged for that in some way, either disciplined or the time's not being approved, you can get yourself sideways with the FMLA if the purpose that they're needing that leave for is covered by that. You can also, and this is where you're going to want to look at your policy language too. First of all, make sure you have a policy. Make sure it's clear. Make sure it provides enough information for employees to understand sort of when it's going to kick in, how to apply for it, and make sure it notifies employees that they can't just say, I need FMLA leave. They're going to need to jump through some hoops. They're going to need to provide some doctor's notes. We're going to need to ask for some information. As far as your PTO interplay goes, you're going to want to make sure your policy says in the policy, when you're on an FMLA-approved leave, you are required to use your any PTO that may be available to you concurrently with this FMLA leave. Now, some employers choose not to do that, but the reason I think most employers choose to do that is because you don't, are probably not, it's not that we're not trying to be generous here, but you're probably not in a position to be able to allow someone to take 12 full weeks of unpaid leave and then still have, you know, 40, 50, 60 hours of PTO to take after that, right? That's quite a lot of time off that you just may not be able to do. So if you require folks to use that PTO at the same time and notify them up front, that will be a requirement, then you're going to be able to cut down on some of that. Kind of the reverse, I see folks who are trying to save their FMLA. So I see folks who are getting shoulder surgery, and you've got a generous paid time off policy, and they just are saying, you know, I'm just going to use my PTO. I don't want to do the whole thing where we apply for FMLA. And they're out for shoulder surgery for a week or two. because they're trying to save their FMLA because they're maybe going to go on parental leave later in the year, right? You don't have to allow that to occur. If someone is taking any time away from work that qualifies as a qualifying condition under the FMLA, you can require them to sort of designate that as FMLA, or I guess you are allowed to designate that as FMLA and deduct that from their 12-week allotment. And it's tricky. You have to, again, in your policy, indicate that not only, you know, you may apply for FMLA, but you may be required to provide information to us that allows us to determine if this is FMLA eligible so that we can count it as such. So you're going to want to take a look at your policy to make sure that there's some language in there that sort of addresses that issue. And I see that most often with folks who have really generous PTO policies. There's just no incentive to put in for FMLA because I've got the PTO, so why does it matter? Well, it does matter, and it's important for us to designate it as FMLA. And then, of course, your actual practices. You know, it's all well and good to have a fantastic policy with all the language that you that your lawyers recommend that you have, but if your practices are such that it's not being enforced and implemented in the right way, that can get you into trouble. So, you know, if you've got managers who are disciplining folks after their PTO is exhausted and not recognizing that this actually may be something that is an FMLA qualifying condition, I think the rule is if you see someone who's absent for 2 or 3 days in a row, that kind of puts us on notice, right? There may be something going on that could be an FMLA qualifying condition. Certainly, if your employee gives you some information that they're getting treatment for something that sounds like a serious health condition, that's a trigger to you to proactively reach out and say, hey, you may actually qualify for FMLA. So your managers have to be sort of on the lookout for those sorts of things, and we really do recommend having some training for managers to just understand how important it is that they help you as HR sort of identify when that might be occurring.
We have a couple, a question and a comment. The comment's an important one. An astute listener chimes in from California regarding a prohibition against using PTO during pregnancy, requiring use of PTO during pregnancy disability leave. And so for our comments today, we'll try to be pretty clear about if we're talking about federal law or our experience in the various laws where we are. But of course, there may be state or local laws that are slightly different, and we'll mention that when there's kind of a clear one. But you do definitely need to make sure that that a particular jurisdiction is on board with the policy.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And for the Federal Family Medical Leave Act, you absolutely can require them to use PTO, but you're right, some of these conditions may qualify under other things. Another one where you can't require them to use their paid leave is, at least in Washington, the domestic violence leave. So if someone is absent for a purpose that falls under that domestic violence leave, and that could look a lot like FMLA if I'm getting some sort of medical treatment for an issue that I'm a victim of domestic violence, under Washington's rule, you have to allow them to choose to take that paid or unpaid. I mean, if they have paid PTO available, they're allowed to use it, but they don't have to use it. They can choose to take that unpaid. So if it's strictly an FMLA issue and we're not worried about any other state laws, you can require them to use it. But that's an excellent point, Darlene, that in California and other certain laws, you can't always do that. I'd say for the most part you can, but not all the time, which is why it makes it fun, right?
Right. So I think where the state law is really coming up a lot, and maybe we can here, is with the sick leave laws. So we've got, as I'm sure you all know, city, state, local, county laws. Currently, we've got statewide in California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Oregon. We have those coming online in Arizona, Washington, Vermont. There are also states, as Jillian mentioned, who say, well, you don't have to provide sick leave, but if you do, here's the way that it has to be administered. And then we just have a spattering of cities all over the place, coast to coast. They're not all the same. They do, with the exception of California, they do tend to sort of follow the same structure. And even California has pretty similar components. It's just more generous. So you really need to take a hard look at your locations with your sick leave. And then as you're designing your PTO policy, make sure that it's either compliant everywhere that you're operating, or if it's not compliant, then you need to have your separate sick leave policy if you're not willing to make the PTO policy that generous. And, you know, some of those components include how fast does it accrue, how much can you carry over, how long until you can use it, is it after 90 days of employment, 30 days of employment, what happens, what kind of notice can you require the employee to give you? What kind of notices do you have to hand out? A lot of laws say that they can take it down to a one-hour increment. So does your PTO policy allow that? Those need to be looked at carefully. And a lot of these laws say that something that's, or some of the laws say that if you have a substantially equivalent policy, that will be okay. But we're going to see litigation over these. We haven't, you know, these laws are too new to have seen a lot of litigation, but what we hear from the state agencies is that that idea of a substantially equivalent policy is okay does not mean that you get to skip any of these components that they want to see in your policy. So, you know, look carefully at what the law requires, and then there are choices within it, right? Do you want to do a lump sum on January 1. So let's say you're in a jurisdiction that requires 40 hours. This is very common. For every 30 hours you work, you accrue 1 hour of sick leave up to 40 hours. That's the way it works in Oregon, and that's very common. So do you want to actually go through the administration of tracking that, or do you want to front load and tell people, hey, as of X date, you know, once a year, you get 40 hours. You can use it for whatever you want. And if you use it up for vacation, if you take vacation January 10th and you use up your 40 hours, then you've used up your protected leave. And if you're sick on hour 41, we can take attendance action against you if we want to. This is one of the hottest issues, I think. Are you gonna just treat it that way, right? Just 40 hours. We're not going to ask you what it's for. We're not going to put any restrictions on it beyond what sick leave law requires. Or are you going to kind of track the reasons and understand why they're using it? And the latter option gives you a little more control over allowing absences or not. So let me give you an example that I've gone round and round with our state agency about. If the state agency in Oregon says yes, if you just give them 40 hours and you let them use it for whatever, you're not going to ask for a doctor's note, you're going to let them take 1 hour increments, you're going to do everything required, PTO, then if they use up 40 hours on vacation, that's their choice as an adult, and you can start managing their performance and attendance at hour 41. The catch is you have to really treat it that way. So if someone comes in and says, hey, here's my 10-day notice. I'm taking 40 hours off for spring break for vacation. Then under our state agency's interpretation, you have to let them. You can't say, well, you know, we really require approval for vacation because you're being required to treat this as protected. So the other option is to actually ask, right? Okay, you're using your PTO. What is it being used for? Does it qualify for sick leave? If it does, we treat it as protected. If it doesn't, then maybe you still have to go through the vacation permission policy. Maybe there's other restrictions that can be put on the priority of that. So it's kind of a tricky situation, and it's really a strategic choice on what the way that you want to handle it. But just be aware that a lot of agencies would find violation if you're going to say, you can use it for anything, and then you're going to restrict purposes that aren't protected, like a vacation, for example.
Mm-hmm. And if you've got like two employees, you have to just alert your managers. Look, before you deny someone the use of accrued time off, you know, let's talk, because it may be that we have to give that time off. And you know, if somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, I want to go to Hawaii," a manager typically could say, "Well, we can't have you go that week because it's, you know, we have a big audit that week or something. But if it's for a sick leave purpose, you are going to have to allow them. So just tell your managers before you ever deny the use of PTO that please talk to HR and make sure that it's appropriate. And hey, Kim and Betty and some folks who have some specific FMLA questions, we'll have to move on to some PTO, more PTO specific questions, but I encourage you to shoot us an email. I'd be happy to answer those questions.
Yeah, and you know, with that point as far as telling managers to slow down and just say, hey, let me check into that before saying no, I think that's a really, really good practice to have in place, particularly with issues regarding sick leave, medical leave, disability accommodations, that kind of thing. There's no reason that you can't say, you know, I don't know if the answer is yes or no, let me get back to you. I think it's really good to have supervisors trained that way. And one idea is to maybe, this is really confusing stuff, and your supervisors and managers may feel defensive that they don't get it. And I think sitting down and having a chat of, look, this is really confusing. That's why we're here to help you through it. Let's just look through, let's just pick two random employees. Let's just walk through their PTO use and explain to me the decisions you're making. And, you know, by going through that process with them, and you can kind of understand, do they get it? Do they know what's happening? Or are they discouraging people from using it 1 hour at a time when it's supposed to be protected leave? Are they still asking for doctor's notes when, if you're covered by sick leave and you're intending your PTO to qualify for sick leave, maybe your state law doesn't allow them to ask for a doctor's note. So kind of going through that process together to figure out, do the people who are dealing with the employees understand this policy or not, I think is important. And the first step, obviously, is to have a very clear written policy in place. But that follow-up step, I think, is really important, too. The other thing I would just mention as these sick leave laws continue to roll out is to, you know, be proactive with your city council or your legislators on what the burdens of compliance are for your organization. And I'll just tell you, the burden of this costs too much is going to fall on deaf ears. They already know that, and they've already chosen to put sick leave in place. But can you talk to them about software in the industry and how it is able to track or doesn't track this? Can you talk to them about when you have to convert people from your system of anniversary dates to this proposed law system of calendar dates, how difficult logistically that is? Because I think those are the areas where you can affect more change up front in what becomes the law and kind of makes your life easier when you're dealing with your PTO. All right, I'll go through disability real quickly. You know, PTO can be an accommodation. I think the key here, what the EEOC says under the ADA, is that if you offer leave, if you offer PTO, then you have to treat disabled folks the same as others. So you can't say, well, now I need a doctor's note for your absence, but you know, it's someone who doesn't have a disability, you're not asking them for that same kind of information. We litigate these interactive process cases a lot. They're not just checking the box. It's such a back and forth. There's always a question whether one more step could have been taken. Should there have been one more conversation to figure out if there was an accommodation or not? And so it's just an area to really pay close attention and, you know, think about the fact when you have a really generous PTO policy, I think you're kind of creating evidence that time off is not that big of a burden to the company. So if you get into a situation with someone who's claiming that they need, you know, a lot of unpaid time off after PTO as a disability accommodation, are you going to be able to articulate why that actually is a burden for the company when they say, hey, you let us take off 200 hours a year? It doesn't seem like it's a burden. So I think you kind of want to walk through those. We have a quick question about sick leave, about whether there's a danger in asking for doctor notes if the absence is 3 or more days. And that is going to depend on your city and state law. So in Oregon, for example, it has to be more than 3 days. So you can't ask until the 4th day. There are some jurisdictions, I believe, where you can't ask for doctor's note at all. I'd have to look through the specifics, but you do have to read the nitty-gritty to make sure, and you know, happy to follow up with that one.
Yeah, and Seattle's the same way. It's after 3 consecutive days, then you can ask. Now, does that mean you want to every time? I mean, I think you just have to remember that if you're going to do it, don't just do it for the people you don't believe, right? I mean, I think you need to be consistent about asking for notes and just explain to employees, look, we just have to make sure we're doing right by you, and there's a lot of rules around absences. We want to make sure we're giving you what you need, and so we require paperwork to kind of keep ourselves straight. It's not just that we don't believe you, and possibly we don't believe you, but don't say that. But yeah, I think there is a risk if, you know, if you're going to just all of a sudden start asking for notes for some folks, it may look like you are out to get them because they have a mental health issue or something like that. So be consistent, as with all HR things, right? So wage and hour quickly. So, you know, the cardinal rule of wage and hour law is you got to make sure people are being paid for the hours they actually work. You know, we're talking about taking paid time off. They're being paid. And so one of the questions we get sometimes is, well, what if they work a little bit from home while they're taking PTO? That's not going to be a problem under the wage and hour laws because they're being paid. So that's not an issue. I think it's better to discourage folks from working. I mean, this is their paid time off. The purpose of this is that they don't work, and you don't want to get yourself into a situation where they later say, hey, you promised me 3 weeks off, but for one of those weeks, I was working most of the time, and now I feel like I should get another week. They may have a point. So I would encourage folks to not work during their time that they're counting as PTO. And then I would say the other big question I get a lot about wage and hour law with regard to PTO is, how do you deal with this with salaried employees? And so, you know, obviously we all know there's salaried folks who are exempt based on the duties tests and the salary basis tests, and they're paid a salary every week, and there's an anticipation that their hours may fluctuate. And that's great. That's fine. So when do you require them to take PTO? And what happens if they're out of PTO? And so if an exempt person is gone during the work week, and it doesn't even have to be a full day, you can require them to deduct from their PTO bank. They're still going to get paid their full salary for that week because it's PTO. But you are going to deduct from their PTO allotment. And that, you know, once they're out of that time, you can sort of use that as a framework to discipline them. Like, hey, you had 3 weeks PTO. You've already blown through that. You're still missing days. You know, you may not be at the point where you want to deduct from their salary, but it gives you an opportunity to say, look, this is how much time we expect people to take off. You've kind of blown through that. We're kind of outside of the realm of being a flexible salaried person. Let's talk about this. You know, and I think salaried folks do expect to have a little flexibility, you know, but I think you can be clear about that to these folks. Look, we generally expect you to be in the office between 8 and 10 in the morning and stay until, you know, this time. If you need to take some time off here and there to go to the doctor, we either are or not going to require you to use your PTO for that. And I will say there are some clients of mine that never deduct from a salaried exempt employee's PTO bank unless it's like a full week of vacation or a full day absence. Others are you know, sort of saying, well, hey, you know, if you're going to take 4 or more hours off, we're going to ask you to go ahead and put in for PTO. And once they're out of PTO and they miss a full day for either personal or sick leave reason, you can deduct from their salary at that point. You can also reduce their salary for shorter partial day absences if they are FMLA under the FMLA intermittent leave scheme. So there's certain just few instances where you can deduct from a salary person's salary. But PTO, you have some flexibility with. So I think you just have to think, you know, how are our salaried folks using this? What are we trying to achieve here by requiring them to use it? And think about kind of how you want to communicate that. I will say that's the number one thing that I think doesn't get communicated well to salaried folks is, what's the deal with our PTO? So I would just encourage you to think about that as you're putting your policy together. And Christy, are you going to talk about some other important legal issues, or shall I? Oh, I can't hear Christy. Well, perhaps,
sorry.
Maybe nobody can. Oh, there she is.
I think that, we did touch on the requiring exhaustion of PTO benefits. Check your law whether that's required, but assuming it is in most jurisdictions, just be really clear in your written policy. Remember that courts and agencies are going to come down on the employee's side if you have an ambiguous policy there.
Can I just say one more shout-out about wage and hours? So in Seattle, the paid sick leave requirement is you have to allow employees to use it in 15-minute increments. That's a change, sort of a recent change that I think people are missing. A lot of folks, the plan will say you can use it in an hour increment. We're not going to, you can't leave 40 minutes early and expect to only get 40 minutes deducted. If it's a protected leave under the Seattle ordinance, you do have to get down to those 15-minute increments. That's just another wage and hour thing I wanted to hit on.
Yeah, and actually a lot of the sick leave laws will say, 1 hour increment or the smallest amount that that the employer uses to track time. So if you're tracking time in 15-minute increments for other people, then your state law may, mm-hmm. or city law may say that you have to do the same for sick leave. This last point on here about obligations of former policies is a really tricky one. So before you go back and you're excited because you know exactly what you want to do with your new PTO policy, check first whether there are vested rights under your previous existing policy. So this is, when we're asked to revise a PTO policy, I think the single biggest factor in how complicated it's going to be is usually what did you have before. This is going to depend on state law, but in a lot of states, and the general rule I would say is if you've promised to pay it out at the end of employment or at some time, then it's going to be vested, and you can't take that away from the employees retroactively. You could still change it going forward, and then you have to figure out how you're going to maybe make them use up the vested time first so that you don't have that liability on the books if you're moving to a situation where you're not going to pay out anymore. But you have to be really careful about that, and I believe California is one of those places where PTO is just vested regardless. So you just really be careful so you're not taking away a right that people have come by. A couple other legal issues: if you have collectively bargained employees, then you're going to have some bargaining issues with your PTO policy, so be careful there. There's some tax issues with the constructive receipt doctrine. This doesn't come up too often, but if you're giving employees the choice to cash out or not in a certain year, that can have some tax consequences. So make sure that you run that by an appropriate person, a tax or benefits lawyer, before you put that into place. And then, of course, just kind of discrimination and retaliation issues. Just make sure that these policies are being applied consistently and you're thinking about whether some people are being treated a little bit differently than others, and if so, if that's because of their job classification or if it could be because of some protected reason. So what are the pros and cons of different types of policies? This is the part that's fun because it's up to you, right? Do you want to treat people kind of on the adult side and say, hey, use it up first week of January, it's up to you, use it as you can? Or do you want to sort of watch over them a little more and track what they're doing so that you have a little bit more control over and knowledge of when they're using protected leave or not protected leave? The payout issue, I still see a lot of policies that, I don't know about you, Jillian, but I still see a lot of policies that have payout. I see some that are silent on this issue, and I think that's the biggest issue, right? You need to make a decision whether you're going to be paying out or not, and you need to put that in writing in the policy so that everybody knows what the deal is there.
I think that's right. I would say most, so in Washington, And I would say most states. I think California is one of the only ones, maybe Colorado, that requires you to pay out unused PTO upon termination. I would say most of my clients are not in those jurisdictions, and most don't pay out. Mm-hmm. And but yet, I also have some that their policy says they won't, but then they still do. And I do think that if you just have a practice of always paying out PTO, that becomes sort of an expectation. And just I think it can sort of change an employee's expectation. And if you do promise to pay it out, it becomes wages. So if you don't pay it out, you're on the hook for, you know, unpaid wages. So it's a big deal. So I would say definitely put it in your policy and then stick to it. You can always pay out something as severance in exchange for a release or something, but I would just say put it in your policy and do what you say.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And then, you know, of course, there's the morale issues. This is PTO can be kind of a bragging point for people with their friends. Hey, guess what my company lets me do? I can be in charge of my own schedule. And I wouldn't shortchange, you know, how much that is worth, how much that's worth for lots of employees.
Mm-hmm. So now you've got some sort of, you know, we've gone over sort of the things to consider, right? The risks and the goals and the things. And so now you're sort of in this position where you can design your PTO policy. And I think it's really, we want to empower you to think creatively, think what works for you. Obviously, you got to stick to some laws and pay attention to that. But don't just go with the model PTO policy that's in some model handbook. Think about what works for you and what you're trying to achieve. And so we want to help you kind of think about that. And if you're in a position where you're planning a brand new one, I mean, that's great. And if you're in a position where you're going to be changing it, either making it more generous or less generous, that's trickier, particularly on the less generous side, to communicate these things. But just start, brainstorm from scratch. What would be ideal? And I think the first step to doing that is just identifying your goals, which we talked about. You know, you see some goals here on the screen, but there may be other goals. I think cost is a huge goal, or, you know, just being mindful of that. And I think how do you go about identifying goals? I think we all have to be mindful of you know, as a lawyer, I think I know what goals should be for this, but that might be different than an HR person's perspective, and it might be different from a manager's perspective. I mean, HR might think, gosh, absences must be an issue. We really want to get some more predictability around schedules. And then if you actually talk to managers, they're like, no, that's not really a big deal. We just really want to retain and attract good people. So when you're identifying goals, I would really think about including the various stakeholders, managers, you know, employees themselves, do one of those, what is it, the SurveyMonkey things with, you know, do new parents feel this way, incoming people, that kind of thing, and really get a handle on what those goals are. So that's the first step.
Okay, so step two. Is kind of how are you going to move through this? We already talked about the legal requirements. The logistical issues, though. Oh, sorry. I think the logistical issues can be just as thorny as the legal requirements, right? So one that I hear sometimes is, well, we need to prohibit PTO during certain blackout periods. Maybe it's retail around the holidays. Maybe it's a seasonal business in the summer. And, you know, that's where you do want to be a little careful, unless it's protected, right? If your PTO is covering sick leave or medical leave or something, make sure that it's clear that you're not prohibited from taking those types of absences. But maybe a better morale twist is sort of the opposite. Maybe rather than blocking it off in blackout periods, you can encourage it during slower periods, either by requiring that a portion of the PTO is used during certain times or somehow incentivizing with extra carrots that will help people want to take it during slow times. You know, occasionally, not often, but occasionally you hear a horror story about someone who rolled it out at a bad time. Everyone cashes out at the same time. Everyone takes it at the same time. And I think it's really important to talk to the operations folks and understand what's coming up and what they need so that you don't kind of get stuck there. A big logistical issue is, I think, the 12-month period. Are you going to use an anniversary date, a calendar date? How are you going to administer that? Are you going to accrue it? Are you going to do a lump sum? Are you going to carry over? There's some state law requirements as far as carrying over unused accrued sick time, so pay attention to that.
And Christy, I will just jump in to say one thing is folks who have really, really generous policies and they're going to move it to a use it or lose it, or at least use most of it or lose it approach. I've helped employers do like a stepped process. So you've got these workaholics, right, who have like 500 hours saved up and there's no lose it component currently. And so you can kind of talk to those people, give them some time to use it, tell them by the following year they're going to need to get down to this level, and then by the following year. So there's different ways you logistically can roll those things out.
Right, which is important because especially if you're someone, if you're a company that has a cash out policy, you know, that can be a really big accrual on the books. It can make your company less attractive if you're trying to sell it in the future. It can be confusing for employees what the rate is when they get cashed out. Is it the rate at the time it was earned? What's the rate? And so I think piecing through each of those and understanding what the liability on the books is and the budget for this is really important. I put addendums in here. I have many clients that like to, rather than sort of make six different policies, have kind of one policy and then an addendum that goes on to deal with, you know, Washington's new law that's going to be a little bit different, so that not every employee is seeing that Washington's getting a better deal or something like that. So that can be a good practical step for morale while still complying with the law. And then, you know, I think you just have to kind of keep coming back to the core principles of the company. And is your PTO policy driving those? And how are you pitching to the business leaders why this PTO policy makes sense because it drives toward those goals? And I guess one other little part that comes up are you going to allow negative balances or not, right? This comes up, as you know, for lots of reasons. I'm 1 hour short from my big trip. I'm a new employee and I haven't accrued it yet, but I sure want to take it. I think a couple best practices are just to be clear in the policy what the cap is on a negative balance, what the formula is, what the procedure is to get approval. I would recommend requiring a written request if you're going to do negative balances. Decide if you're going to have only certain types of reasons that you could actually go into negative balance, or if that is something you're going to leave open. What's eligibility? Do you have to have no corrective action in place, for example? What's the payback schedule and the consequence of not doing it? And one last little tricky one is repayment on termination. So a lot of state laws are going to tell you whether or not you can deduct a negative balance from a final paycheck, and that might be prohibited. So consider whether you're trying to deduct, whether that's lawful in your state, and whether instead you need to just have a repayment agreement, which, you know, you may not get back, but perhaps you can incentivize by tying it to something at termination of value. And if you don't, you know, if you don't pay it back, then you're not eligible for rehire, that kind of thing. So not everyone wants to do a negative balance, but if you're going to do it, I think you have to plan ahead and not kind of be inconsistent about it and not well thought out.
And I've been alerted that I was cutting out, so I don't know if I'm still cutting out. So, Christy, I may have you take the lead on our last couple of minutes here. But I would just say, and does it sound like I'm cutting out now? I don't know. But I will just imagine it was brilliant, whatever I was saying there. I would just say implementation issues, you know, definitely over-communicate. I just don't think you can communicate enough on these things in terms of FAQs and flyers and meetings and big meetings and then small group meetings and one-on-ones if people have questions. You know, particularly if you're dialing back your benefits, or if things are changing that may be perceived as negative, I mean, that's when you talk about the purposes and why we had to do it this way, and here's what we considered. And I just don't think you can communicate these types of changes enough And we're almost out of time, so maybe we'll just go to the wrap-up. Christy, do you want to close us out?
Yeah, I'll just make two real quick points here. One is I think sometimes employees are hesitant to say they don't get it. Some of us have very vocal employees, but some don't. So, you know, maybe you can have your spouse read the policy and just say, does this make sense? Do you have any questions? Right? Because that's like your new employee who gets it or doesn't, and you really need them to understand what it is that's allowed and what it is that's not allowed. You know, think through those ideas of how are you going to prioritize requests? Is it going to be first come, first serve? Seniority, those two things are often thought of as the fairest, but there are some other options for rotating people through or how you're going to do that. And I think having those open communications, answering questions about it, talking to your employees and saying, is this working? Is this not working? Why isn't it working? Because it's not attracting talent like we thought it would. So we're going through all these extra hurdles, but it doesn't seem to be helping us. Or, you said we could have unlimited PTO, but my manager never takes any time off, so I'm sure not going to take it either, right? I don't want to look bad, so I'm not taking it either. Kind of understanding those unintended side effects, what are managers valuing, what are employees valuing, can make you sharpen that plan. So it's not just a draft it, send it on its way, and move on to the next busy thing on your desk. I would calendar a reminder 3 months in to kind of get a group of managers, line employees, everybody, and say, what do you like? What works? What doesn't? So you can figure out how to shape mm-hmm. it the best way you can.
Yeah, I would say PTO is, you know, you can email the change to the travel reimbursement policy. You can email that around, and that's just not maybe going to be that big of a deal. But a PTO policy is something you got to really, I mean, it takes months to roll these out of planning and communicating and giving people a heads up. And so I can't stress enough to really take it, you know, seriously. So as we wrap up, we're 2 minutes over, but somebody's asking about the typical amount of PTO for a new hire. I think it depends on industry, but I think folks all sort of have a sense of what the sick leave ordinances are. They're usually about a week. I think a week or two is what I would say is typical. I don't know, Christy, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's about right, certainly depending on the industry and, you know, somebody's how long someone's been at their prior company and what they're used to, but I think that's about typical.
Somebody else is asking about basically what we've been talking about is if the Seattle sick leave requires 15-minute increments, but your PTO policy is for full-day usage, do you recommend changing your PTO policy? I mean, you're definitely going to have to address it. Whether you just decide that all PTO can be taken in 15-minute increments from here on out, or if this is where you drop some sentences in your policy that says unless your PTO is for one of the purposes covered by the Seattle Sick and Safe Leave, you can use it differently, and here's how that works. And then you got to make sure you're really finding out why they're using it, right? So yeah, I mean, if your PTO policy just says full day usage, that's not going to be compliant with Seattle's law and probably others. So definitely address it. There are some legal issues there.
So thanks, everyone, for joining us. We are available afterwards if you do have any questions. I think hopefully you feel empowered to take charge of your workplace, although there's some legal issues that certainly arise. You have a fair amount of flexibility with PTO to design it the way that you want to, understand how your employees are using it or not using it and why, so that you can get something in place that works for both employees and for the company or organization's goals. So hopefully you all found this valuable and got a couple good tips out of it. We really thank you for your time and appreciate it.
Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you. A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you very much for attending.